go right in the row?
Yes, we can.
And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 202.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard how Senate Bill 202 on April 13th it requires farm labor contractors to provide workers' compensation insurance for workers as a condition of being issued a farm labor contractor's license. The reason we couldn't hold a work session on the bill was because the Bill 202 and Senate Bill 203 were red marked as bills that needed conflict amendments. However, after further scrutiny, that's not needed, so we can move the bill as is.
All right, I'd be willing to entertain a motion on Senate Bill.
Mr. Chair?
Who was first?
Doesn't matter.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, if the committee has any questions, Christy Hammond from Boley is available.
In the sake of bipartisanship, Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 202 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 202 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill on the floor?
I'd be happy to carry it.
Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 202 and open a work session on Senate Bill 203.
Senate Bill 203 increases the amount of damages recoverable from a person who acts as a farm labor contractor without possessing a valid farm and labor contractor license or violating provisions of the Farm and Forest Labor Contract Law from $500 or actual damages to $2,000.
And we've already had this?
Yes.
Same thing?
Same thing, yes.
And any discussion or concerns? I'll entertain a motion.
We've heard this?
Yes,
sir.
There must have been when I was there.
There was some concern about some conflicting languages. Didn't exist.
May I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Maybe
absolutely.
Some of the members here.
We have Christy Hammond from Boley here.
What's the $2,000 magic number from 500? Why? Where'd we end up with that?
Did you catch all that, Ms. Hammond?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Schaffler. Representative Escobar, Christine Hammond, Bureau of Labor and Industries. The $2,000 is the same amount that is currently available in civil penalty damages. So I think the proposal was that the $2,000 for private damages would be comparable to the same amount if a civil penalty was to be assessed. This is really a private right of action damage. It's not something that the Bureau pursues, but it would be something that a person that had been damaged by these unlawful activities could recover. And currently the minimum amount recoverable is $500. And it's been that amount since... Our maximum amount is 1983. Yeah, I'm sorry. Maximum amount.
Good. Any further questions or comments?
Do we have a motion on this yet?
No.
I would entertain a motion to pass this on, please. Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 203 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves. Thank you, Ms. Hammond. Representative Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 2203 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Vice President
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wilby.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
I would. Representative Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this on the floor? Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on House Bill, or Senate Bill 203. And before we get going here, just so the committee knows, and I've shared this with Representative Smith, I want us all to show up as prepared as we humanly can be. We don't have to have a work session on the same day of the first public hearing, but if we can do it, get our work done in an expeditious fashion, as we have been all session, I'd like to do that. With all that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 403A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 403A directs the Bureau of Labor and Industries to adopt rules which allow tipped restaurant workers to waive their meal periods. It also prohibits an employer from coercing affected employees into waiving a meal period and establishes a penalty of up to $2,000 for violations. And there's also a sunset date of the measure of January 2, 2012.
And Mr. Perry is going to come up here and convince this labor and old bartender why we should let these hardworking people skip their meal period.
And I wanted to bring somebody more beautiful and intelligent than me with me.
Very good. That always helps.
Okay.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Bill Ferrer at the Oregon Restaurant Association. And this is a Senate Bill 403 is something we've been working with the Bureau of Labor and Industries in during the interim. We filed for a rule on this, and we worked out an agreement, and so they actually denied the rule so we could go through the legislative process. I would say that, not speaking for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, they don't feel good about waiving meal periods in Oregon. But what we try to do is I want to give to you why the specific example of, we didn't ask this for all restaurant employees. We asked for a specific portion of restaurant employees. And those are people that receive tips. And actually, Representative Holvey gave me a question in the hallway about, does this only apply to restaurant employees that do tips? And at the bottom of the first page, it does deal with just food and beverage servers. So anybody else that receives tips, it would not apply to them. But what happens is that I have to give the meal period right in the middle of the shift, which is generally the highest revenue hour for our servers. And this is the only position of all the positions I know in all other industries where a majority of their income does not come from the employer. It comes from the customer. And so the customer generally leaves why some of these people are on meal periods. So they end up losing some of their income because they are forced to leave the floor and they don't want to. They approached the Restaurant Association with this problem a while ago, and I said, well, you got to make your pitch to the commissioner, and then we will try to work something out with them to do that. So they received over 100 letters to do this. Once they opened up the rule, they got about 150 emails, I believe. And so we started down this path, and the reason why we're doing it through legislation and not rule is the commissioner wanted to make sure that there was a penalty for coercion. So the way this is drafted is if I coerce, if you miss a meal period, it's $1,000 or possible penalty. If I coerce them, it would be double out of $2,000. And we had no issues with that because, like I said, it's the employees that are asking for this particular provision. So that did not concern us at all. So all this bill does is it says he has to go to rule. He gets to define how you opt in and opt out. And we've been working on that. It allows for $2,000 penalty for coercion, and then it sunsets it in 2012. So if it doesn't work, it goes away automatically. If it does, we'll extend it.
Representative Schaffler, members of the committee, Christine Hammond, Bureau of Labor and Industries. That's exactly right. The commissioner was particularly interested in having the sunset clause so that we could review this after it's been in effect for approximately 4 years and see how it's working and what kinds of problems, if any, arise out of this exception for tipped employees. But he is willing to, we have received a lot of correspondence from tipped employees that are food servers that say it's a problem for them having to take a meal period during the middle of their shift. So he's sympathetic to that issue and is interested in looking at how this might work.
Thank you. Just for the record, when I was in college, I'd work 10-hour shifts in the tavern I worked there and not take any breaks. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is for Ms. Hammond. I think this is a reasonable bill, to tell you the truth. I've known some folks that have worked in this industry for quite some time. But I'm wondering, just one question, how would you substantiate that coercion has happened?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holvey, I know one of the conditions the commissioner has already proposed is that the employee somehow make an affirmative request for the waiver rather than be given a waiver as one of their employment papers that they initially sign when they go to work for an employer. So it would be an action on the part of the employee to actually request the waiver as opposed to the employer suggesting that they request the waiver. Also, the commissioner is interested in making sure that employers don't somehow pressure employees by saying everybody else here you know, has waived their meal periods, and it's kind of an expectation of the job. We also anticipate having some sort of notice provision that employers would be required to provide to employees, advising them that they could contact the Bureau anonymously if necessary, if coercion had taken place, so we could conduct an investigation. Those are just some of the preliminary things we've thought about during the rulemaking process. We might come up with some other ideas to address that issue.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, am inclined to support this bill. And I guess I thought Mr. Perry might be disappointed if I didn't ask him anything about it. So
well, I would have been, Representative.
Wondered if it is common practice for people to have, I know I've observed this in restaurants, where people are having meals before the restaurant actually gets busy at the beginning of their shift, or sometimes after it closes, that you see the people who work there having dinner afterwards. So do you think that's commonplace?
Representative Rosenbaum, Chair Schaffler, I would say that I kind of hate to say this on the record, but this is probably one of the most commonly broken laws we have in the restaurant industry, just because I schedule, or my members schedule servers to take their breaks, but a lot of times they don't, and then they try to take them at the beginning of the end, which is not necessarily legal. And so that's what, even though we reschedule them and try to force them to do it, sometimes our managers don't enforce it. And so there are issues, and I think even the commissioner acknowledged that this law is being broken today. The issue is also it's complaint-driven, and so the servers aren't complaining. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to fix it, is if the law is being broken and they're not complaining, meaning the employees don't want it, we should fix this to try to prevent any future problems. But it is, I think, when you look at the issues that were brought up earlier, we agree it should not be a condition of employment. If you're going to give them a waiver at some point in time, it shouldn't be when they sign their original papers or first week they sign up. We have talked about, you know, after a week of duty or something like that, giving them the option to come forward. And so, you know, it is a problem today just because people are breaking the law, and we're trying to prevent that from happening. The other issue that came up is I have no proof that they're taking it today, and so a lot of our members would say, take your half hour, but I can't prove that they took their half hour, so then I would force them to clock out. Well, that made them mad because then they lost a half hour of pay that they were receiving earlier. But it was the only way technically I could prove that they took their break, and I could prove when they took their break, which created more problems, which really has been the impetus of this bill, is said, okay, now that I'm losing my tips and a half hour pay, you know, I want you to try to fix this for us. And so that really is what did it, is when I tried to force them to clock out so I could tell when they were taking their break, some of the major chains had some problems with their employees.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any more questions of these nice people? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 403A today? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 403A. I'm comfortable with the work section. I hope the rest of you are. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 403A and entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 403A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves Senate Bill 403A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to carry this bill?
I can carry it if you'd like.
Have you already got one today?
No.
Okay, Representative Escobar.
There's two yesterday.
Okay. Well, we don't want to overwork you, Representative. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 403A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 545A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 545A allows an experienced Oregon funeral service practitioner to be licensed without the current statutory requirement of possessing an associate's degree. It requires an aggregate 48 months of service as a practitioner apprentice or an embalmer apprentice. It deletes specified time periods between the apprentice experience and the examination. It changes the current out-of-state experience that's necessary to obtain Oregon licensure from 2 years immediately preceding to 3 of the 5 years preceding applying for an application. It also deletes the requirement that out-of-state requirements be substantially equal to those that are currently required in Oregon, and also specifies that licensed practitioners and embalmers may have no more than 3 interns at one time.
Thank you. Wally Ordman, please. And John Brannaman, if you'd like to come on up too. John, you want to come up too? welcome if you'd like.
Sure.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir. Forgive me.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ordeman, and I'm a fifth-generation funeral director from Albany and a past president of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. My testimony today culminates a lengthy process of evaluating apprenticeship and reciprocation law at the request of our membership, who have found the current statutes to be restrictive and, in some cases, prohibitive. The bill language and the amendments are the remedies suggested by the OFDA committee and board, as well as the staff of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board and the director of Mount Hood Community College's Funeral Service Education Program. Regarding reciprocation, funeral homes have been frustrated at the inability to attract out-of-state licensees. Currently, a licensee in another state must have been licensed for the 2 years immediately preceding prior to applying for licensure in Oregon, as well as come from a state that has guidelines very similar to Oregon's. This current criteria doesn't allow for any pause in the process, such as securing a position with a funeral home, nor does it respect the other state's licensing requirements. Senate Bill 545 would provide a more realistic cushion of time for obtaining a license in Oregon, while more effectively recognizing the licensing authority of other states. Before any remarks on the apprenticeship remedies, it's important to note that Oregon recognizes two licenses in our industry, the funeral service practitioner and the embalmer licenses. The funeral service practitioner license requires an associate degree, while the embalmer requires graduation from a funeral service education program. The duration of the required apprenticeship for each license is the same. The apprenticeship remedies in Senate Bill 545 don't change the duration of the apprenticeships, but rather provide for an aggregate time frame for completing the apprenticeships, as opposed to the restrictive consecutive 48 months as it stands now. Currently, the requirements don't allow for an apprentice to walk away, most likely for educational purposes, without that clock continuing to tick. This reform to the statute would provide some much-needed flexibility while still discouraging lifetime apprentices. The language in the bill regarding interns through funeral service education programs would allow for mortuary students to more easily find positions in the metro area for their required internships. This bill also remedies a rare but important circumstance that can arise. An older Oregon licensee who obtained their license prior to the associate degree requirement before it was instituted, that has retired, let their license lapse, or leaves to work in another state, who wants to return to license status in Oregon could bypass the associate degree requirement provided they have 4 years of experience. This courtesy is already being extended to out-of-state licensees, but not our own. Before entertaining any questions that you may have, I'd like to add that this legislation is being proposed to make it more efficient for your local funeral directors to do business in Oregon. These remedies provide them much more flexibility in hiring and retaining employees while still maintaining the standards and the credibility of our industry. The Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board has voted to support this legislation, and the bill has no fiscal impact on the board. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. John, you have any comments? Any questions, these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to testify today on Senate Bill 545A? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 545A. Does the committee feel comfortable working this today? I most certainly do.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 545A and entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 545A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves Senate Bill 545A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, very good. Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill on the floor?
Sure.
Representative Edwards. Thank you very much. And Mr. Ordeman, you're going to have to forgive me, but I know he was just dying to carry that bill on the floor.
And you have an awfully nice suit on today, too.
Wow.
Leave him smiling on a happy note. going to close the work session on Senate Bill 545A and welcome a public hearing on Senate Bill 748A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 748A allows active certified public accountants or public accounting firms that are licensed and based in other states to prepare, advise, or assist in the preparation of tax returns for Oregon residents or businesses for fee without authorization by the Oregon Board of Accountancy or registration with the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners.
Thank you very much. And I have Steve McConnell and Jen Anderson, please. And gentlemen, whenever you're ready. And Rob? Rob, are you going to test Mr. Douglas? Okay. Whenever you're ready, sir.
Representative Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stephen S. McConnell. I'm an Oregon CPA and a member of the Legislative Policy Committee for the Oregon Society of CPAs. We call ourselves the OSCPA. And thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you about Senate Bill 748. Over the past several years, it's become apparent that it's difficult for people who are licensed in other states as CPAs to perform various services in across states. Unlike drivers situations, even though in a driver's situation you have the ability to pass an exam in Oregon and drive legally in any other state in the United States, CPAs, even though they all pass the same examination, are licensed under different experience and education regimes and have to get a license in each state in which they practice. It becomes more complex when the issue of what is defined as practice enters the issue. And as things currently stand, a non-Oregon CPA must register with the Oregon State Board of Accountancy in order to sign an Oregon resident individual income tax return. This creates a trap for unwary CPAs practicing, for example, in the state of Pennsylvania. Even though that Pennsylvania CPA might not ever set foot in the state of Oregon in the course of doing that tax return, he's still required, or she is still required, to register. So the OSCPA and the Oregon State Board of Accountancy, the Accountancy Board, have discussed this issue and have agreed upon Senate Bill 748A, which would provide for, as your administrator indicated, the tax practitioner statute, which currently requires an Oregon-licensed CPA, would be clarified to exempt any CPA from falling within their rules. The accountancy statutes would provide that a tax preparer from another state will not be deemed to be holding out and therefore subject to the accountancy board rules when preparing an Oregon tax return without an Oregon license if the tax preparer has no state has no office in Oregon, and the use of that practitioner's firm name as a part of the tax return preparation would not be considered the practice of public accountancy in Oregon. In addition, the Board of Accountancy and the OSCPA are working toward a broader solution for some of these cross-border issues, but we believe that this Senate Bill 748 is a good practical first step in trying to resolve some of these difficulties.
Thank you.
Sir, go ahead.
Chair Scheffler, committee members, for the record, my name is Jens Anderson. I'm an Oregon CPA, and I'm the treasurer of the Oregon Board of Accountancy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this Senate Bill 748 as amended. The Board is not aware of any opposition to the Senate Bill 748A. The Board of Accountancy and the Oregon Society of CPAs collaborated in drafting this amendment. The Board consulted with the Department of Revenue and the Board of Tax Examiners about the revisions in this bill, and we were advised that neither of those agencies have any objections to the provisions in the bill. Senate Bill 748, as amended, addresses an important mobility concern regarding tax preparation by certified public accountants who are licensed by another state. Oregon law now requires certified public accountants to be licensed by the Board of Accountancy in order to prepare individual tax returns in Oregon or for Oregon clients. The amended bill acknowledges professional skills held by certified public accountants, whether licensed in Oregon or in another state, by removing the licensing requirement that is specific to certified public accountants who are, one, licensed in another jurisdiction, and two, do not maintain an office in Oregon. Senate Bill 748A maintains public protection. The licensed certified public accountant demonstrates competency through licensing requirements regardless of the state that issues that license and remains accountable to the licensing authority for professional services performed. The requirements to have an Oregon license for Oregon tax preparation is not necessary for public protection and creates an additional regulatory hurdle. The Board of Accountancy joins the OSCPA in requesting the committee support of Senate Bill 748 as amended. Thank you.
Anybody know Ed Hodgson?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's our accountant. Yeah. You can always count on Ed.
No, that's right. I've known Ed for years.
A lot of puns today, I guess. Yeah, he's really a great guy. Any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if in your discussions of this bill, and maybe it's not an issue, I suppose, of a reciprocal agreement with other states to make sure that they allow accountants in our state to do the same thing in their state that you're allowing the accountants from Pennsylvania, for example, to do in Oregon. I kind of expected to see that somewhere in this bill, and I don't see it, and maybe it's not an issue. I'm just curious what your take on that is.
Representative Schaffer, Representative Holby, this is an issue which the profession has been working very hard with state boards of accountancy. I mentioned earlier in my testimony that we will be talking about this issue with the board further. Currently, the American Institute of CPAs and the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy are cooperating on provisions which we're trying to create uniformity amongst all states, which would provide for this non-registration requirement. None of those provisions would require reciprocity because that just adds one more constraint. But by simply eliminating the registration, we believe that across the states there will be that will simply encourage state cross-state acceptance of other licenses, and it's less cumbersome for us to go that way than it is to set up a required reciprocity requirement. Is that responsive?
Yes, I believe it is. Answers my question to some degree, but I get follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
But I guess it doesn't eliminate the possibility there may be some states that are out there that may not allow this to happen, and in such, you know, there would not be really an equitable trade-off between states, but I guess you're willing to go down that road and accept that. And if your accountants in Oregon aren't worried about it, I guess that's their choice.
Yeah, Representative Holy, Representative Schaffer, yes, that's right. We feel that by taking this position, and other states are taking the same position, that there will be a snowball effect that will, if you will, ultimately embarrass those states that choose not to be reciprocal into ultimately becoming that way.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Please. I just hope after, if in fact we pass this bill on, becomes law, that I don't hear from my accountant upset with me because down the road he doesn't think this is fair because he gets stuck in a scenario that I just described.
I would be delighted to talk to him.
Okay.
I'm sure Ed will let me know. He's a great accountant. He's saved my wife a lot of money. I just want to be right. He's a sharp guy.
Like I said, I've known Ed for a long time.
Yeah.
Interesting discussion.
He's a wonderful man. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what's the motivation for this? I mean, following up on what Representative Holby was saying, I mean, it's odd. Usually industry groups are looking for more protection from out-of-state industry groups, and it kind of going the other way. So what's the motivation?
Representative Edwards, Representative Schaffer, the motivation is that increasingly many practitioners are crossing state lines in the work that they're doing, and what has historically worked is no longer working. Increasingly, I mean, imagine you as a driver attempting to drive in the state of Washington and having to get a license in the state of Washington before you cross the interstate bridge. I mean, that's really essentially what we're dealing with. You can kill somebody in a car. you can't kill somebody by signing your name on a tax return, although you may cost them some money. And what we've seen over the close to 100 years that CPAs have been practicing across practicing in the U.S. is that as there has been more and more interstate practice, it's simply become. I heard an example today of a state of New Jersey. The licensing requirements in the state of New Jersey are such that for somebody who is practicing and wants to do some work in New Jersey, but who happens to be based, this is an international firm, in Hong Kong, they're having to send their people all the way to New Jersey because of the peculiarities of New Jersey law. That's just goofy in a global economy. And so we have concluded as a profession, and Jens is sitting here nodding his head, we've concluded as a profession we can't operate using horse and buggy rules anymore.
Well, I think the accountants aren't actually known to be a bunch of rowdy, fly-by-the-seat-of-their-pants bunch of folks. I know Ed Hodgson isn't. If they want it, I'm willing to support them. Any more questions of these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 748A? Yeah, please, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Reese, and I'm the administrator for the Board of Accountancy. I may have a more specific response to Representative Colby's question, if I may.
Yeah,
Oregon is one of perhaps two states in the United States that require a license for the preparation of taxes. So in response to your specific question, Oregon is one of the only states that says you can't come in here unless you've got an Oregon license to prepare taxes. And CPAs more and more find that they have clients who have tax returns that are affected by many states. They may own real property or have a family member or something in another state. And if Oregon is one of those states, then the CPA is required to come in here and get a license with us first. So very specifically on this issue of preparing individual income taxes, Oregon is the one who's kind of on the outside. Other states already allow this crossing.
Thank you for that clarification. Any questions?
Thank you.
Representative Wolvie.
Just a follow-up with that, do other states have this reciprocal requirement that keeps Oregon from...
No, they do not.
Oh, interesting.
They do not.
Well, it sounds like it's time to bring Oregon on the inside.
Exactly. That's the purpose of this.
Any further questions, Ms. Reeves? All right, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
That. Anyone else today on Senate Bill 748A? All right, close public hearing on Senate Bill 748A, and I'll entertain a motion if the committee wishes. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 748A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 748A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to carry this bill on the floor? I'm counting on one of you.
Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Representative Hovey.
Thank you very much.
I didn't want the funeral service practitioner to feel left out, so I'll do my accountant puns.
I can count on you, Mr. Representative Hovey.
All right, with all that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 748A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 559A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 559A eliminates guarantee contracts as a method of providing workers' compensation coverage and authorizes the issuance of workers' compensation insurance policies in place of guarantee contracts. It requires insurers to notify employers about non-renewed workers' compensation insurance policies and establishes requirements for policy term-based filings related to proof of coverage and the termination of coverage by insurers. It also allows the Department of the Consumer Business Services to adopt rules which regarding the electronic filing of proof of coverage information, and it also establishes the measure being operative on July 1st, 2009.
Thank you very much, Teresa. I have John Schultz, Sean Miller, and Brian Miller. Please, gentlemen. Okay. Sit on down, sir. We'll have Brian up when you're done.
Okay.
Whoever's first, go right ahead, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 559A. The first thing I'd like to say is you probably noticed this is a large bill. There's a large amount of pages here, and I want to assure you that a lot of that is because of the term guarantee contract. That term shows up in five different chapters of Oregon revised statutes. So to do what we want to do with this bill in eliminating the use of guarantee contracts, it means that we need to amend quite a few statutes. Some background here is that in Oregon, a workers' compensation insurance policy, just like you would expect, is a contract between an employer and their workers' compensation insurer, where that insurer guarantees coverage of the employer's workers' compensation liabilities. In fact, in most states, the insurance policy is the only contract required to assure that workers' compensation liability is covered by the insurer. In Oregon, the issuance of a policy actually causes the filing of a second contract, the guarantee contract, which is an agreement between the insurer and the state, or the insurer and the department. It's a second level of assurance. Under the guarantee contract, the insurer also assumes the employer's liability for payment of compensation to injured workers in terms of a guarantee to the state that it will do so. This dates back to 1965. And over time, the requirement for this secondary assurance or second contract between the insurer and the state has evolved into a system that's both costly to administer and doesn't always reflect the reality of the underlying insurance policy. The guarantee contract system is unique to Oregon, and it does create a special challenge for our multi-state insurers. The Workers' Compensation Division and the Department have been working with stakeholders over the past few months to determine if there's a more streamlined approach for filing proof of coverage information that could be developed. And the results of those discussions is this bill, Senate Bill 559A. This bill would eliminate the separate guarantee contract, and instead it would allow insurers to simply report insurance policy-based information to the Department of Consumer and Business Services to satisfy their statutory proof of coverage requirements. The bill changes the focus of our regulatory work at the department away from the guarantee contract to a focus of coverage reporting and regulatory activities that link to an insurance policy rather than the existence of a guarantee contract. SB 559A doesn't require anything new or additional from employers or worker leasing companies. The changes of the bill are really administrative, and they're focused on the responsibilities of the insurers and the department that regulate those insurers. Now, the transition from a guarantee contract-based system to a policy-based proof of coverage system is going to require some significant planning. It's going to require some operational changes. We're going to have to change our data systems. We need to reprogram. We're going to need to go into rulemaking activities, which we intend to do with the usual public process, to allow all parties the necessary time to come up to speed for these activities. We put an operative date on the bill of July 1st, 2009. The department however, is allowed to take necessary actions to put system and rules in place before that operative date, so we could start the rulemaking process before that date to allow us to get get the rules in place, the programming in place, and the systems in place so that we could go live by July of 2009. We expect to, if this bill passes, to start the rulemaking process immediately in 2007, and it probably would continue a ways into 2008. So what do we get from doing this? Frankly, the insurers in the state of Oregon will have administrative savings from this. Right now, they have to not only manage the issuance and maintenance of policies, they have to manage the issuance and maintenance of guarantee contracts as well. This would eliminate that entire secondary level of assurance. So as a result of this bill, there's administrative savings for the insurers. Typically, insurers would pass those savings on to their insured employers. The Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee reviewed this bill and voted to support it. The Senate passed this bill unanimously, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can about this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller here today on behalf of Liberty Northwest Insurance. We've been working on this bill in the interim for several months, worked with the other private carriers prior to session, including Safe Corporation. I know Chris was just here but had to leave, as well as management and labor, because when we looked at this particular change in law, we wanted a system change, a system benefit to not only benefit the Workers' Compensation Division and easier administration of proof of coverage, save money from administration on the insurers, which obviously is a savings to our employer, our customers, and also look at benefits to the workers and the injured worker, which this bill does because it gives a more accurate, real-time reflection of proof of coverage. Currently, as Mr. Schultz indicated, you have a guarantee contract and you have an insurance policy, and sometimes they can be different. When a guarantee contract or insurance policy were to lapse in some cases, and it's different, sometimes injured workers are caught in the middle of that. I know in conversations we had in the interim, an injured worker who may have be caught in that situation could have up to 45 days of investigation time. In that period, they're not receiving benefits. What we're providing, and this is a real-time, you know when you're covered and when you're not. The employer can check in and make sure, for instance, their subcontractors are covered. And so, you know, the benefit to employers to make sure that they have workers' compensation coverage, and the benefits to the injured worker so they're not getting caught in that in-between, again, this very antiquated system of a guarantee contract is what we're trying to accomplish, and very supportive of Senate Bill 559. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just introduce...
This went through MLAC, right?
Yes, okay. MLAC approved, and David Lake, our Vice President of Policyholder Services, took a lot of time working on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Lake, representing Liberty Northwest Insurance. I just want to add a couple of points. You've been well briefed on the major points of this bill. The first point that I'd just like to reinforce is that the stakeholder group that was put together to work on this bill under the direction of Mr. Schultz was a broad-based stakeholder group with many insurers from within the state and also multi-state carriers. The second thing is that you should note is that the process that exists in the state of Oregon today for notifying is a non-standard process. It's in the states that we do business in, it's the only state that does business this way. And so what we're moving toward is a more standard system that is used by most other states within the country. I believe... The one final thing is in our written testimony that we provided to you on the back page, we've tried to summarize the bill in one easy page with five or six benefits that are broad-ranging there and reinforce the idea that there has been no opposition to this bill thus far.
Good. Any questions, these gentlemen? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And... John, I was just kind of curious, you know, you made a statement about changing the database system and getting all this, you know, up and running before the July 09 date, and I was listening to that, and I'm sitting here looking that there's no fiscal impact to this, and is this because this is something that
you already have FTEs or people in the workers' comp division already doing similar things, so it's, I'm just wondering why there isn't a fiscal impact of this. It's kind of surprising to me.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct. We are already staffed with staff that work on not only the data system already for tracking proof of coverage. We also have staff that enters the data, but we were already engaged in a process of looking at a redesign of our data system, and that was already planned. This is more of a, instead of just redesigning inside the box, it's more of a re-engineering the box. So we do not think it's going to require any additional staff to do this, although there's going to be a substantial amount of work for not only us, but for the insurers as well in terms of reprogramming their systems. The work is definitely there, but we were planning to do like work anyways. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. Thanks.
Before I make at least one of these guys move for the other, Mr. Miller. All right. Mr. Shields, stay up here just in case, please. Thank you, gentlemen. Brian, whenever you're ready, go ahead. Just in case anything arises. Thank you. Which I'm confident it won't.
Good afternoon, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Miller, here today on behalf of Farmers Insurance Group. And rather than restate and rehash the testimony you've just heard, I'll simply state for the record that Farmers Insurance is also supportive of Senate Bill 559A, and we've submitted written testimony to that fact. So I, too, would be welcome to answer any questions if the committee has any.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Miller. All right. Any further questions, these gentlemen? All right, thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 559A today?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5559A. The committee is interested. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 559A. Representative Berger, please.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 559A engross to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Move Senate Bill 559A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Kristen, please.
Representative Ray.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill? Representative Berger.
I will do it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 559A and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 747A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 747A establishes the means for unclaimed cash vouchers, which are issued at horse racing meets and off-track betting sites, to be voided after a 180-day period, with the proceeds to be used for financing benevolence and education programs for nonprofit associations that are affiliated with the horse racing industry.
Megan, we ain't putting up with any horsing around in this committee room.
Oh, no.
Athena Zeke is here, and Dick Carney.
Tough in the afternoon here.
Ms. Zeke, please go ahead whenever you're ready.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Athena Zeke. I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, and I'm here today to speak about Senate Bill 747A. We are in full support of this bill. You've got a handout there. I think I'll just go quickly down the points on there. And the second page is a real brief description of our organization's benevolence program, which is where these funds are going to go. I'll start with that this, we're trying to create a new statute to address the cash vouchers. And the horse groups have come to an agreement on how to pay those out to the groups, the OHBPA, the Thoroughbred Breeders, and the Quarter Horse Racing Association. And we would all use those funds for benevolence and education programs. Again, You can refer to the second page. You may be asking, what is a cash voucher?
Yeah.
You have one in front of you. It is part of the wagering system in the sense that instead of change, as in a dollar form or cents, you can get a cash voucher, or I believe these now say credit vouchers, and they are exchangeable for money with a live teller. And as with anything that's small and paper, many of these get lost, washed in your pants pockets that night, or wadded up and thrown in the trash on purpose because it's of insignificant value to you. We would like to have all of those missing cash vouchers be claimed by our groups after 180 days of the close of the live race meet. So these people would have 6 months to find all their cash vouchers in their old jacket pockets and get them cashed in or to use as a credit towards another bet on a horse race. And then after the 180 days is up, we would be paid 210 days later out of that account. The Portland Meadows Racetrack already has an account that they have to carry for the liability of these. They have no idea when somebody might trade in a cash voucher for cash. I don't know if you have any questions at this
point. Athena, I do have a question, just for the record. This is a real credit voucher?
That is.
Just for the record, these are for 30 cents. We all got one, and I'm putting mine right here.
That was for reference.
For you to come and gather up, because the horse track is not giving us cash credit vouchers today. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say it if you didn't.
Get that out on the record. Representative Berger.
Is there... I haven't read this bill. Sorry, Mr.
That's quite all right. No, I understand. We're moving at a fast pace.
Is there anything in here that says that when one of these are issued, if this bill is passed, when you issue a credit voucher, that it would have on it, or is there a statutory way you can say this is a credit voucher, but it's in 6 months you won't be able to come back? Something that tells people that it's not valid if they pull it out of their pockets 6 months later, or it's going to be given away or something. It says you have to inform the public that they're, I mean, this is 30 cents. Otherwise, we wouldn't be giving it back, you guys. I mean, if this didn't have value, this wouldn't be an issue here. So I guess I'm worried about the consumer not realizing he's losing his value.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, I don't think in the bill it says that we have to print that on there. And as far as the 6 months is concerned, you could buy it the first day of the race meet. The race meet runs nearly 6 months, so you'd actually have 12 months to use it. And if we did begin to print on there, it would say 180 days after the close of the live race meet, which I believe Mr. Cartney could answer in a moment, is very soon. It ends the beginning part of May. And I suppose you could put a sign up right next to all the tellers and the machines. Generally, that kind of common knowledge runs real fast through the community that does parimutuel betting, and it is not going to affect the county fair race meets. They do not have the equipment that uses the cash voucher system. They only do the tickets, the parimutuel betting tickets.
Representative Esquivel.
Do we know how much money we're talking about on this whole thing? I mean, 30 cents, I know it won't help much.
You want to shed some light on this, sir, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dick Cartney. I'm the executive director of the Oregon HBPA. I can't tell you exactly how much money. Apparently, this fund has been building for some time, so we're not sure exactly what the number is right now, but I think probably around $200,000 has been building over a period of time. On an annual basis, this is an estimate only, it's about $18,000 to $20,000 per year. Of course, that depends on how many people throw these things away and how much it is. I might try to answer the question for Representative Berger with the regard to the notice. Customarily, with like they do with wagers, which is a different animal altogether, rather, what we would do something similar with the cash voucher would be toward the end of the race meet, they would post a notice in the racing program and also in the mutual area that all wagers have to be cashed within 6 months or they become void. So we do post notices so folks will know that they have a time limit to do that.
Just so I know before I go to Representative Holby, and this is going to go to scholarship programs, education programs, all that money will be donated?
Yes, at my organization, we're a nonprofit organization. Uh-huh. We represent owners and trainers and who race and train thoroughbreds in the state of Oregon. Also, we represent their employees. Mm-hmm. A lot of the employees are low income. A lot of them don't have very much money or resources. Mm-hmm. So as part of our mission as an organization, we try to provide benevolent programs for those folks. We have a dental program. We have a vision program. Mm-hmm. We have scholarships. We have a drug and alcohol counselor on a part-time basis, comes in 1 or 2 days a week. Some medical, we have benevolence. People get hurt or sick, can't work for a period of time. We make sure that they don't go hungry and try to help them keep afloat till they get back on their feet. So it's a very important issue for us. And some of our other folks, Oregon Thoroughbred Breeders and the Quarter Horse folks, are more into the educational part of it, although we do some educational programs too. But it would be very, very helpful to us to be able to keep these programs going and possibly even expand them somewhat if this bill is successful.
Well, good. Thank you for doing all that. Representative Holby, please.
Mr. Chair, my question was probably pretty much what you just asked and what you got your answer to. I was just kind of curious what the benevolence program was going to do with this money, and I think you just sort of described it to me.
Great. Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For my clarification, these cash vouchers, are these purchased? They're purchased and then they're used for wagering, explain to me a little bit better.
If you don't mind, I'll try that. When you go to a track or an off-track site, you can go do two things. You can go to a teller, or you can go to a self-service machine. We have a self-service machine which will actually take money, and it will give you a credit voucher, just like you have there. It's just like cash. That can be used to put in the machine, and then it's a touchscreen machine, so you can make your wagers that way, and then it'll just deduct the amount of your wager and leave you with a credit voucher of a smaller amount. You just keep doing that all day long until you get to the end of the day, and you've either used it all up, or as Thina said, you have a few cents left on it. Or you can, if you want your money, you can take it to a teller. Teller will give you whatever money you have on it. But that's pretty much what a credit voucher is.
Representative, please.
So how is this different from a gift card? And does this regulation, we just passed a gift card in the House. Mm-hmm. And does this run afoul of, or does this qualify as a, not to really confuse things, but
I'm not going to ask these nice people to comment on the gift card issue. But
no. Maybe that's a question for, I don't know who that's a question for.
Representative Edwards. I would think that it'd be kind of like comparing maybe a casino token to a gift card. It's mm-hmm. I think it's different.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know where to begin to explain how or why, but I do believe that it's a different type of credit voucher.
Right. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on Representative Edwards' question, I don't think it does conflict with the gift card bill, but we can certainly ask, and I can ask my committee administrator to look into that and get back to Teresa on that issue. But I had one other question that kind of popped into my mind. What happens to this unclaimed cash now?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holby, nothing. It's sitting at Portland Meadows waiting for somebody to cash in all those 10-cent, 30-cent, $15 vouchers.
So it's just a pile of money sitting there with nobody has the ability to access it?
No.
And it's all going to go to these benevolent
That's what we're
purposes.
Hoping. That's what, if the bill passes,
yes, no, I understand.
It
Thank
would
you.
Do.
That,
yes.
That's, and Representative Foley, would you put Representative Smith's voucher up on the counter? Because I want to make sure everybody knows we're not getting any cash credit vouchers here today. Any more questions of these nice people? You know, I would like to find out as things this work works out, you know, where it goes, who it helps, how much is spent on what in the future, just so we have some follow-up on what we've done here. Because I think, you know, I'm confident it will go to all those things, but I want to hear about it. I want to get a report on it, and I want to find out what, you know, how many people you helped, all that good stuff, because it's a good thing.
Sure, we'd be happy to follow up on that.
All right, very good. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 747A today? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 747A. Does the committee feel comfortable working this today? I most certainly do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 747A, and I'll entertain a motion. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 747A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Escobar. I move Senate Bill 747A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I'm comfortable moving this on at the moment, but I'm also sort of curious about unclaimed property, and I'm just kind of troubled by the fact that this unclaimed property, it doesn't fall under some sort of existing statute that deals with unclaimed cash in some way. So I'm just kind of, I just want to follow up with that. But I'm not going to hold the bill up for
no,
that.
No, Representative, I think that's a very valid question, and I would encourage anyone, you and anyone else, to go to Legislative Council and follow up with that question. And we'll send it to the floor, I assume, after the vote. And then in the meantime, we'll find out. I think it's a valid question. It went through the Senate with no problem at all. Maybe that question's already been asked, and we just haven't met the end. Either one of you want to comment on that before we vote? Thank you for your patience.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holvey, Athena Zeke again. I don't know why it hasn't ever moved, but the part about Department of State Lands did come up and unclaimed property.
Mm-hmm.
I actually looked at that website today, and it wasn't real clear on something like cash vouchers, but it had traveler's checks at 15 years and bank accounts at 5 years. And there was one other money thing that was 7 years.
Right. I don't expect you to be an expert on
that. Because we had a similar bill around session, certificates of deposit or CDs. Right. That's the other item.
Yeah. And so it was hard for me to understand where it would fall in there, but I would suppose that nobody's really paid attention to the fact that this would be unclaimed property at the Portland Meadows track, the people that are handling the account. And it would, Senator Ben Westland pointed out that if it did go to unclaimed property, it would then go to the
Common
account,
School Fund?
Commons, well, that raises interest for the Common School
right,
Fund
yeah.
until it was claimed. And we just still would like to use it for benevolence.
Uh-huh.
As I said, I don't know why it has never moved that direction. The operators of the track have been unclear on that.
Any further questions? Representative Edwards, excuse me.
Well, just and in clarification of my own question that I asked earlier about how is it different than gift cards, as I've been thinking about this, the gift cards are the money that's not used on a gift card goes back to the profitability of that company.
Mm-hmm.
This is just sitting here in a pool, so I think there's a clear distinction there, so
right.
I'm fine with.
And they're going to give it away for good causes.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
in other words, that's a horse of a different color.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. thank you.
I knew we couldn't get away with it.
Thank you, Athena. I appreciate it.
All right. Any other discussion and excellent puns today? Before we vote. All right, Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. The good chair will carry this bill on the floor. All right, I'm going to close work session on Senate Bill 747A. Anything for the good of the order? All right, you're adjourned.